Here's the plan for the next few weeks. We have a very special occasion coming up at the end of September. It is our 70th anniversary as a church. Probably you know that because we've been preparing for it for a little while now. And in honor of that occasion, I've been doing some historical research. And that may have become a little bit of an obsession for me, but I hope I'll be able to share some interesting and useful outputs from it. We have some historical records for the church. There's the session minutes, which is like the records of all of our session meetings over the years, going back to 1956. So that's about, it's about seven volumes of minutes and, you know, lots of unremarkable details in there. But then if you know what to look for, there's also patterns and statistics and things like that. And then the presbytery minutes also going back to, I was able to get them going back to 1964. That's when our presbytery reorganized in its present shape. We used to be part of what's now the Southern California Presbytery. I decided I wasn't committed enough to email the clerk of the Southern California Presbytery and tell him I'd like him to scan his minutes so that I could have my, but I did get our clerk to scan our minutes. So I was able to read those. And the other thing that happened that I was very thankful for is that I remember a few months ago I alluded to the fact that Pastor Corey, well, he liked to name churches first, right? And I said I'd be really interested to find out what the name of the church was that he pastored before he was a missionary, like in the earlier part of his ministry. And our friend Bob Herman did a little historical research that week and found some source material that I hadn't come across yet. And that actually triggered a rather, well, I was on vacation, so it was using my own time, and so I don't feel guilty about it, but I spent quite a night of finding, I found all sorts of material that I was quite excited to discover was on the internet. The internet has amazing stuff on it. I mean, it is incredible what you can find. So putting all that together, I ended up with quite a bit of material, and I'm trying to put it in shape for a bit of a narrative of our church's history. But it starts with the biography of Henry Corey. So that's where we're going to start today. So here we go. Henry Warner Corey was born on June 23rd, 1904, in Pittston, Pennsylvania, not far from Scranton, if you know the area. In Corey's childhood years, the region was a growing center of industry, especially coal mining. There's a picture in the Museum of Modern Art in New York of the Breaker Boys, which are these coal mining boys in 1910. It's kind of a famous picture. They would pick rock and slate from the coal as it went past on a conveyor belt. And that was the kind of industry that was happening in West Pittston, Pennsylvania. Most of those coal miners were immigrants from places like Ireland or Eastern Europe. Henry, his family his upbringing was rather gentler. His grandfather, George Corey, was a prominent figure in business and politics. He served a term in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives not long after the Civil War. And George's son, Elisha, which is Henry's father, he followed his father into business as a real estate agent and also into politics, serving five terms in the Pennsylvania State Legislature. And in 1896, Elisha married a woman named Sally, and the couple had three children. Henry was born in 1904, and he had an older sister who was 5 years old, Eleanor, and a two-year-old brother, Edward. So that was the Corey family that Henry grew up in. So they would have been a wealthy family of some significance in the local area. There's actually a neighborhood named after them in the area, and in other ways, they're kind of a well-known family in that part of the world. Interestingly, just around the time of Henry's birth, his father Elisha was ordained a Methodist minister. So he added the pastoral ministry to his portfolio. He was a politician, businessman, and now minister. He later joined the Christian and Missionary Alliance, if you know that denomination, serving as a pastor and then as a traveling evangelist. And that helps us understand the religious context of Henry's childhood. The Alliance was an evangelical denomination. Not as formally organized as maybe some of the Methodist, Episcopal, or Presbyterian denominations, a bit more of the sort of Wild West context of church life. And the tradition featured a very heavy emphasis on sanctification. You may have heard of the term higher life theology, which is associated with the Keswick movement in England. That would have been the strain of spirituality that was prevalent in these circles. The Pentecostal movement was growing at the time. That would have been just adjacent to the Christian and Missionary Alliance. They had a kind of parting of ways between a more Pentecostal side of the group and a less Pentecostal side. So that's the context in which Henry grew up. And so he was in his home and church community provided with sincere examples of Christian life. And his father particularly must have been a real model of Christian leadership and evangelism, to be so multifaceted and to devote himself, especially in his older years, to the work of ministry and evangelism. That would have been an impression left on Henry. In 1923, Henry enrolled in Wheaton College. At that time, Wheaton was a small Methodist college, and Corey made his first profession of faith that year. our source for that point is a comment a decade later in a Presbyterian magazine called The Guardian. And I tried to figure this out. The comment doesn't clearly indicate, was that the occasion of Henry's conversion to faith in Christ? It's not clear. It seems likely that he simply joined a Presbyterian church for the first time in 1923, and that was his public profession of faith as he became part of that church. But I don't have a source to confirm that, but that seems the best interpretation of the evidence. Wheaton was having a Presbyterian moment in the early 1920s. In 1925, this small Methodist college hired a prominent conservative Presbyterian minister named J. Oliver Buswell as its president. Buswell was actually the youngest college president in American history at the time, and he may still hold that honor. He was like 26 or something when he became president of this college. This was the height of the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the Presbyterian Church, and Buswell was a prominent opponent of liberalism, and I guess that was a major factor in Wheaton rallying around his leadership. He was just a little bit younger than another prominent conservative Presbyterian leader, J. Gresham Machen, who was at that time professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. And you may remember his famous book, Christianity and Liberalism. That book came out in 1924. So that gives you a sense of the moment of history that we're in when Henry was going to Wheaton College. This was really the sort of the peak moment of the fundamentalist modernist controversy. Machen and Buswell, a decade later, were both put out of the Presbyterian Church for their fight against liberalism. But that's a story for just a tiny bit later. So whatever Henry's church affiliation was when he entered Wheaton, as far as we can figure it out, we know that he was a sound Presbyterian by the time he graduated in 1928. After graduating Wheaton, he enrolled in Princeton Theological Seminary to study with Machen. And it was a very tumultuous time at Princeton, because the liberals in the Presbyterian Church were working overtime to reorganize the seminary to wrest control away from the more conservative faculty. And they accomplished that reorganization in 1929. And when that happened, Machen and the other conservative faculty members all resigned. And they became the first faculty of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. And about 50 students joined them, enrolling in that new institution, and Corey was one of that first class of Westminster Seminary. Machen clearly left an enormous impression on his students. And Corey was no exception. Years later, Corey actually wrote a biography of Machen in the pages of that of a magazine, Christianity Today, which is not the magazine founded by Billy Graham. It was another magazine that was run by Presbyterians at the time. These articles include personal reminiscences of Machen's warmth toward his students and incisive analysis of the conflict of liberalism. I think we actually have Corey's biography of Machen here in the library. I should have found it before I started, but I'm pretty sure it's there. Corey graduated Westminster in 1931, and he was called to pastor in his hometown at First Presbyterian Church, there it is, of West Pittston, Pennsylvania, so his hometown. It was a large church. They had 651 members at one point in the records. And Corey, he was a talented young preacher, and he soon won the hearts of his congregation. They clearly loved him. And it seems likely that his long background in the community, his well-known family, and other connections must have been part of the reason that this big Presbyterian church desired his ministry. The same year that he was ordained, he got married to a woman named Elizabeth Bem, Betty, as she was known. She was 2 years younger than Henry, and she had graduated Wilson College in South Central Pennsylvania. They were married for 71 years, and their marriage was a really amazing ministry partnership. Henry died in 2002, leaving Betty a widow in Southern California, and their marriage seems to have been kept on the private side. Mark Bube, a former member of our church, shared memories of how Henry would often protect Betty from the spotlight and things like that, just because she wasn't so interested in that side of life as a ministry wife. So there's not a lot of historical insights that I have about Betty, other than a minister in Washington State once told me that when he was planting the church there in the Seattle area, Betty Corey would write him notes and send them small gifts for their family to encourage them. And that was a ministry that she had in her later years. So thankful for Betty's ministry. And I'd love to know more. If I end up finding more, I'll share it. We get a little glimpse of Henry's ministry at this time from a sermon published in this magazine, Christianity Today. Remember, not the one that we know by that title. It was an earlier one. And this sermon was published in September 1932, and the title was The Loss of Certainty. And the text was 1 Corinthians 14:8. If the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle? If you know the early OPC ministers, you know that was a favorite text. I think Westminster Seminary still has promotional material with that text emblazoned on the front. It's an important text to those who were part of that controversy. And in this sermon, published as an article in the magazine, Corey worked to show that modern scientific learning is uncertain in contrast to the spiritual authority of the biblical authors. And the theme and the tone of the sermon, I think, are very reminiscent of his great teacher, Machen. Anyone who's familiar with Christianity and liberalism will probably recognize Machen's influence when I read this little quote about how the apostles changed the world. Here's Corey. But it reminds me very much of particular passages in Christianity liberalism. Here's Corey. A little handful of men went forth into a universe of hostility. They told a story that centered about a majestic person, a cross, and an empty tomb. And they not only moved the world, they turned it upside down. These apostles were used mightily because they were in the vice-like grip of a conviction that Jesus Christ was the only Savior of mankind. That's just a little snippet of Corey's ministry at that time. Reflecting on the whole article, one thing about it is you can really see Corey's broad education. In fact, you can almost see it a little too much. It's a little bit, the temptation of a young person to show off his education a little bit seems to be there. He alludes to Tennyson and Shakespeare and H.G. Wells and Sir Arthur Eddington and these other sort of literary and scientific figures. And there's almost, too many allusions to them, but it is clear that he was really a broadly educated man. And, along with reviewing evidence and citing authorities and analyzing things, you can also see his lighthearted personality in this sermon, because here's a comment that he makes about Piltdown Man. Have you ever heard of Piltdown Man, the missing link fossil that they discovered? It was on display in, I think, New York at the time. And it turned out 20 years later to be proven to be a hoax. It was suspected all along to be unreliable evidence, but it was proven in the 50s or 60s to be a hoax. But anyways, here's Corey about this whole Piltdown Man. And he's reviewing a specific article here. The most satisfactory bit of information that you gather from this article is that the Piltdown Man is the oldest of six varieties of prehistoric man, having lived about 1 million years ago. This calculation is made by Professor Henry Fairfield Osborne, who measures time by elephant's teeth. So, Corey wasn't too impressed with Henry Fairfield Osborne. Now, at this time, Henry really had an ideal ministry situation. He was a newlywed minister with an excellent education, pastoring a large church in his own hometown. And surprisingly, from a human point of view, Henry expressed interest in serving as a foreign missionary. And he applied several times to the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions, the missions agency of the Presbyterian Church, but his applications were denied. And I mean, this isn't in the records, but I think he was probably denied because he wasn't a liberal. That was the situation at the time. If you weren't a liberal, you weren't really getting anything you wanted from the various church agencies, which were all controlled by pretty intense liberals. Missions at the time was a real flashpoint in the larger fundamentalist modernist controversy. In 1932, there was a famous book, well, not famous, but at the time it was influential, called Rethinking Missions, and it was published with Rockefeller money. John Rockefeller, the oil billionaire, was a Presbyterian in New York, and he was kind of like the, you know, the shadow liberal funding source for all the stuff going on in the fundamentalist modernist controversy. And with that money, the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions sponsored this book, and the book called for a really liberal attitude to missions. And the idea was to, you know, have more cooperation with non-Christian religions. That was the vision that they had of missionary work. And one person who endorsed the book was a famous novelist, Pearl Buck, who was actually on the roster of Presbyterian missionaries at the time in China, which is an astonishing thing if you know anything about Pearl Buck's views on things. She was not a Christian, but she was a Presbyterian missionary. And it was in those circumstances that Machen organized the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions. This is where anyone who knows their OPC history is really starting to, you know, sing the tune. This is very exciting stuff. The Independent Board, the purpose of it was to provide faithful Presbyterians an avenue to support missionaries who would maintain historic Christian orthodoxy. They didn't want their missions donations going to, you know, Pearl Buck and her friends. Let Rockefeller fund those guys, and we'll fund real Christians going to the mission field. J. Oliver Buswell was another character who participated in the forming of the new mission board. Another one was Carl McIntyre. These are some of the influential Presbyterian conservatives at the time. And the Presbyterian Church interpreted this as insubordination. And to make a long story short, for insubordination, they deposed Machen, Buswell, and a series of other ministers in 1936. And that injustice against them was the occasion for the formation of a new denomination, which was at first called the Presbyterian Church in America, but then the old church sued them and so on, and they landed on the name the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. So that's what happened in 1936 and following. But actually, Corey's own biography anticipates some of these developments because he had his conflict with the Presbyterian Church earlier. In April 1934, he and Betty were appointed as the Independent Board's first missionaries. So that's maybe our church's greatest claim to OPC fame, is that our founding pastor was the first appointment of the Independent Board, which is real royalty around here. The board's supporters greeted the news with enthusiasm, but Corey's presbytery disapproved strongly. And in September, his presbytery, the Presbytery of Lackawanna in the Presbyterian Church, the old mainline one, voted to erase Corey's name from its roll. So they erased him. And their only reason was that Corey had signed up for missionary service with the Independent Board. Which is a remarkable occasion for church discipline. Imagine somebody saying, I want to be a missionary, and then the result is a discipline case against them. That's quite extraordinary. But discipline case is even being too generous, because they didn't have a case or a trial or anything. They just deleted his name. That was all they did. It was very unceremonious. And so that's an example, an early example of the injustice that was inflicted quite generally on these faithful ministers. Somebody wrote in to Christianity Today, that Presbyterian magazine, and described the situation. And I'll read this because it gives a good sense of what was going on. Henry Corey's name was erased from the roll of his presbytery simply because he refused to lay down the call of God at the command of men. He insisted upon crossing the ocean to preach the gospel to the heathen, and so he is blotted from the roll. No charges lay against him. His doctrinal soundness was unquestioned. His achievements as a pastor were distinguished. Had he gone out under the official board, the same presbytery would doubtless have banqueted in his honor. But he goes out under the Independent Board. You must preach the gospel to the heathen under our auspices, says the presbytery in effect, or you must stay home. Henry Corey went and thereby deserves lasting honor. Thus the opinion of this letter to the editor. Now, the presbytery may have disapproved, but the Presbyterians of West Pittston heartily supported their young pastor. On October 8, 1934, more than 500 of them filled the auditorium of the local high school for a farewell meeting. And at that meeting, it was really a star-studded meeting. Many prominent conservative Presbyterian leaders were there because of their connections to the independent board. So there was Clarence McCartney, Carl McIntyre, I'm not sure about Buswell off the top of my head, but the president of the meeting, the sort of the MC of the evening, was Machen himself. And Machen later in the pages of the magazine Christianity Today reviewed the circumstances of Henry's decision to pursue missions. Here's Machen's comment. He says, he was pastor of the West Pittston Presbyterian Church, a church of 651 members. As pastor of that church, he was signally blessed of God and greatly beloved by the congregation. Every ordinary human consideration would have led him to remain where he was. That was Machen's comment on Henry leaving for China. And Henry and Betty said their goodbyes and left all of this behind. And 2 weeks later, in late October of that year, they set sail, actually from Vancouver, BC, on the Empress of Japan, bound for China, which is where they went next. Now, they began their missionary work in Beijing, which at that time was called Peiping. I don't know if any of my Chinese friends know the context, but given the controversy between the communists and the nationalists and so on, there was different names for different cities. And their first impression was to be overwhelmed at the sheer size and population of the country. In a new magazine, the Presbyterian Guardian, which just started around that time, the Presbyterian Guardian is the... It was sort of the semi-official magazine of the OPC for a long time. Not quite officially, but almost. And in that magazine, Henry wrote an article sharing how he learned to make new relationships. So here's Henry from the mission field describing his approach. You lead off with a grin, give your unworthy name, make fun of your wretched use of the language, apologize for living, and soon you have the train car laughing with you. Without a doubt, the grin is the young missionary's most disarming weapon. So that's a good glimpse of Henry's lighthearted personality and his effective approach to evangelism. Meanwhile, the controversy was still unfolding back in the Presbyterian Church. As I said earlier, things came to a head in 1936. Machen was deposed, and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was formed on June 11th of that year. Controversy followed in the first few months of the new church's life. The ministers who formed the new church were all theologically conservative. If you were comparing them against liberalism, they were all on the same side of that controversy. But there were differences among them. They were divided over some of the distinctive issues associated with American fundamentalism. Machen had always been a bit of a strange ally for American fundamentalists. These Christians were often dispensational in their theology and premillennial in their eschatology, and they often were very focused on opposing the use of alcohol, the use of tobacco, and what might be called as worldly entertainments. That was like a really big feature of their ministry and spirituality. And you know, Machen was a more urbane character. He was known to have really good cigars and whiskey, things like that. And he was just a very cultured, you know, member of the old Southern upper class. And he wasn't culturally really on the same page with some of these distinctive fundamentalist emphases. He certainly wasn't premillennial and dispensational in his theology. He was much more similar to the actual, you know, plain old Westminster standards on those issues. Now, some of Machen's colleagues in the new church were more sympathetic to these fundamentalist distinctives. And in 1937, a group of them, led by Carl McIntyre, left to form another new church, the Bible Presbyterian Church, which is another denomination that continues to exist today. Glancing over at Matt and Joy, who grew up in the Bible Presbyterian Church of Singapore, which has some affiliation, right, with the American Bible Presbyterians. The Bible Presbyterians was also the church closest in sympathy to the church I grew up in, the Free Presbyterian Church, but that's another story for another time. I know people who were at McIntyre's funeral because they honored his memory. But, you know, So basically, this controversy is unfolding back in the States, and it affected the Corays because they were out in China under the auspices of the Independent Mission Board, and now the Independent Mission Board came under the control, basically, of Carl McIntyre and his side of the new church, the more dispensational, premillennial, Bible Presbyterian side. And the Corey sympathies did not lie in that direction. So they resigned from the Independent Board and accepted an appointment from the OPC's new Committee on Foreign Missions. And they were one of the first missionaries appointed by the OPC. Not quite the first. I think he might have been the third missionary, but I'd have to check the details. But it was a matter of just months in between, so it's not a competition. Now, Henry and Betty spent almost 5 years in China. There they welcomed two sons, Andrew and Donald. They came home on furlough in 1939, just months before World War II broke out in Europe. And their third child, their daughter Virginia, was born in March 1940 in Philadelphia. In September 1940, they returned to China. And at that time, tensions were already rising quite noticeably in the Pacific. Not long after their arrival, the State Department began advising that American missionaries return home. Andrew and Donald, their boys, had also been ill. And so Henry and Betty decided to return home in November. So they'd only gone back for 2 months, which, you know, isn't the most efficient use of sailing time. But such was life. They had to make a decision. And it was the end of Henry's work in China. But actually, back home, a new phase of missionary work was beginning. And looks like I have a few minutes more for a little bit more of this narrative. So when Henry returned, the OPC's Committee on Home Missions sent him to plant churches in California. So his role was missionary in China, and then back home in the States, he was called as a home missionary by the presbytery. That was his specific call. He moved his family to the Los Angeles area and began planting First Orthodox Presbyterian Church of Long Beach. This was the first of several churches that Henry would help to plant during his ministry. By my count, he helped to plant 11 churches over the course of his ministry. I am not 100% sure. I might have that off by one, but 11 is the number that I've got in my mind. Now, it was no accident the church was near a golf course. Henry was an avid golfer, and over the years, many of his colleagues would spend time with him on a golf course. The family lived in a small two-bedroom home, 900 square feet in size. You can still see it on Zillow. I've got the address if you want it. And that really illustrates the financial difficulty facing ministers in the new OPC denomination. Imagine raising a family of three kids in a 900 square foot home in Long Beach. That would have been challenging. Years later, this is now at the end of Henry's ministry, he wrote this reminiscence about his ministry, and he said this: "I cannot but wish that the younger generation in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church would realize the tremendous amount of sacrifice made by some of our home missionaries when our movement began in the late 1930s. You would appreciate more the efforts of the pioneers. Blood and toil and sweat and tears were poured into the foundations. I know of men whose monthly salaries, when they received them, came to $25. There were unsung heroes in those days. I do hope our young people will not forget it." And he didn't mention his own personal sacrifice in that reminiscence, but I did some digging. And in 1940, on the census, he reported a regular salary of $1,500 per annum. So that would translate today to about $36,000 a year, regular salary. And he was raising a family in the Los Angeles area. That's pretty minimal. That's like significantly below any thresholds that I can find for a reasonable salary from the time. It's possible he received other income occasionally. I wouldn't know that exactly. But you can tell this was a huge financial sacrifice, especially when you think about the fact that his father and grandfather were successful businessmen and politicians. You can sort of fill in a picture of Henry's sacrificial attitude to ministry. Years later in Sunnyvale, even, his financial stresses continued. 1 year, he had to work as a part-time public school teacher to make ends meet. And for several years, at least, Betty also worked outside the home to support the family and make it all work. So that's one aspect of the legacy that the Corys left. Now, during his first years at First OPC of Long Beach, Henry's gifts as a home missionary were in full exercise. He was pastoring the Long Beach Church, but he also helped to plant two more churches in a place called Garden Grove and also in La Mirada. Isaac and Ellie Chavez, friends of our congregation, are members of the La Mirada Church today. At the heart of his church planting leadership was his own efforts in evangelism. He described his methods in a 1946 article in the Presbyterian Guardian, and he described a very direct and proactive approach. So here's what he did for neighborhood evangelism. He made a list of families that he could visit, asked the church to pray for them, and then he called on them and he asked them for a time when he could come to give them a full presentation of historic Christianity. Combined with door-to-door ministry, this approach was instrumental in building up the churches that he planted in Long Beach and elsewhere in the years following. And in that article, he expresses, you know, I used to just, you know, visit and hope that enough small talk would lead to a good gospel opportunity. And eventually I realized, no, I'm just wasting my time. I'm just going to book appointments with people. So he booked appointments with people that were, you know, almost strangers to him and said, I'd just like to come over and tell you the full message of the gospel. It'll take me about an hour. And he would book that appointment. He would spend time in their kitchen telling them the basic message of the gospel. And actually, he had great fruit from that type of ministry. And it's an interesting example of his missionary gifts. Corey shared more of his approach when he gave a lecture to the Presbytery of California in 1950. That lecture was subsequently published in The Guardian. And the title was Missionary Methods of Paul. And I like this because it really gives us a good insight into Henry's thinking in the years leading up to his move up to our area to plant this church. So Corey said, the Apostle Paul's plan for missions included wide itineration, selecting strategic points for church planting in each region, training converts to assume responsibility for regional ministry, and organizing churches as self-supporting from the start. Against objections that such a plan would not work in modern America, Corey replied, I really like this quote, well, it would be an interesting experiment to turn men loose and see what could be accomplished. Some of us in California are attempting to put certain features of the plan into operation. That's another good example of Corey's leadership style. So the method described in the lecture does fit with Corey's actual work. The Long Beach Church served as a hub for regional church planting, and that led to the establishment of these other churches in La Mirada and Garden Grove. And then in 1955, the Presbytery of California sent Corey to the San Francisco Bay Area. Corey, at the time, saw a need for a faithful Reformed church in the area around Stanford University. At the time, there were OPC churches already established in San Francisco and Berkeley, and there was a brand new church in South San Francisco that had just been planted. And in these post-war years, the defense and aerospace industries were expanding rapidly in the South Bay Area. The population of Sunnyvale went from something like 5,000 before the war to something like 50,000 after, to something like 80,000 in the early 60s. So it was really growing, you know, from a farm town basically to a modern industry center. Also, the region was emerging as a center for advanced research into electronics, which would soon earn the nickname Silicon Valley. That nickname comes from the late 60s, if I've got my facts straight. But, you know, that work was beginning. And around this time, some families from the Long Beach Church actually moved up to the South Bay Area. So Henry had some connections and a new opportunity to plant a church that could be an anchor for his regional evangelism strategy. That's, I think, where we'll stop today. The next big section of what I've got tells the early years of his ministry here in Sunnyvale. But I've got some time if anybody has questions or reflections or memories. Jim?
Well, I was just going to say one thing.